This is a production of Cornell University.
UA meeting, February 24th, 2010.
Thank you. So, I call the meeting to order, even though I realize we haven't got a quorum quite. And the first question is, are there late additions to the agenda?
Not a late addition, but just a quick report from the CJC. If you would.
That's right, that comes under committee updates.
I wasn't sure if we had it on there.
We don't, but we'll put it there. That seemed reasonable. Anything else from anybody else? Okay. All right, well then it's going to be hard for him to mention. All right. Then I would like to introduce Paul Streeter.
Paul? Thank you, Chuck. So thanks for having me. I wanted to cover, thought it might be of interest to you to cover three topics today, but in each of which you can poke as far with me as you want. One was I wanted to give you a quick reporting out on the budget model task force that the provost had charged, what we had done and what our proposal was coming out of that work. Two, give you a brief update on where we are from a budget standpoint for the university. So just so you know, I'm in the Division of Planning and Budget, so we've been working a lot on the financial situation. So give you a quick update on that, and then three, talk to you briefly about what we're doing in terms of pursuing what we're calling administrative cost savings. So those are the three topics I was going to cover, and I hope that that works. So let me jump into with the budget model task force. This was a task force charged by the provost back last July we were charged with providing a recommendation for a single university budget model. We right now manage the university under at least four different budget models, depending on how you count things, and we tend to have different budget models based on the type of organization. And starting with the colleges, we have really three different budget models for the colleges, depending if you fall within what we call general purpose college, arts, architecture, art and planning, and engineering, contract college, law, or vet, CALS, ILR, and human ecology, and then what we call a designated college, law, Johnson School, and hotel. And all that means that in our current world, we think about the flow of different revenues or different expenses depending on what kind of unit you are in receiving these. So we treat undergraduate tuition, for example, differently. For some colleges, the money flows to the provost, and then the provost decides how to allocate it out. For other colleges, the money flows directly to the dean, and the dean decides. And these differences make a real difference in how the deans think about different issues, how the provost has to think about different issues, and over time, it affects our behaviors on campus. It incents department chairs, deans, and faculty in a different manner given the different budget models because they see the whole reward and incentive system is different, you know, in the financial realm. In some places, it's too much. I mean, it means that the financial considerations drive decision-making more than perhaps it should. So we were tasked with coming up with developing a recommendation for a single budget model, which we have done, and we delivered our report to the provost back in December. You can find a full copy of the report in the Dean of Faculty's office as well as the Assembly's office, I believe.
Yes.
And we've got an executive summary of the report on the website at cornell.edu/reimagining. And everything really I'm talking about is in, you can find it off that website. So we developed a single budget model recommendation. There's some critical elements to it. I'll mention a couple of them. But the biggest theme is I've kind of spoken to from the problem standpoint. One of the biggest themes of our solution is we want to treat similar revenue streams and similar expense streams in a like manner so that the way we handle the way we allow tuition to flow, undergraduate tuition, it flows the same for all colleges. It's not different based on what college you belong to. Or how we treat graduate tuition or professional school tuition or how we treat expenses, the recovery of different expenses that occur around campus, that we treat them all the same. It's not dependent on what unit you're in. It's based on the nature of the expense or the nature of revenue. So let me just mention a couple elements of it, and then I'll just take questions on it. The if the model were adopted, and where the model is right now is just a recommendation, the provost is considering input, and likely, my guess is over the next month or two, he'll make a decision on whether to adopt this new model. One of the big elements that we've recommended is the notion of creating a undergraduate tuition pool. So pooling tuition, undergraduate tuition, we're calling it an undergraduate tuition pool that will then be distributed back out to the undergraduate colleges. And what it does is it takes the, if you will, the ownership of the tuition dollar in the first instance away from the dean, and it puts it in this pool, and then it distributes it back out on a variety of factors. And we haven't decided all those factors yet. Our task force was really trying to put a framework. We weren't the detailed implementation group. There will be another phase to this. But the framework was that we would pool all the tuition and then distribute it back out based on factors such as college of enrollment, college of teaching, the cost, the differential cost of education, because there's obviously a difference across different disciplines on what it costs to deliver the education. And then likely also factors around priority of where the institution is heading or where the provost wants to put provost and deans think there should be an emphasis. So the notion being we treat undergraduate tuition as a shared resource, because fundamental to our recommendation was that our task force valued undergraduate education as a shared responsibility across all colleges. So given that we believe that, and undergraduates do take courses across all colleges, that given that fundamental belief that it's a shared responsibility, to some extent we think the resource should be treated in a common manner. And again, that's not done currently. So that would be a significant change. We're not sure how the change would play out by unit, and we didn't model it. So we didn't say how much would arts get now, and how much would engineering, and how much would ILR. We didn't go to that level of detail, because we actually think that depending on the factors, it can work out in a variety of ways, depending on how you weight these distribution factors. Yes, sir.
So you mentioned the priorities where the colleges or programs may go. So does this mean just educational priorities, or could be any priority?
So what I'm referring to here right now is really around the undergraduate experience, and so undergraduate teaching. I'm going to talk about something else that would be investment around a resource for the provost to invest in more institutional priorities that would probably cross into research support or any other kind of support. So what you say, not from the tuition pool. Let me describe this other resource then, and then catch me if I didn't cover it. So pooling undergraduate tuition is one concept. The other, in response to your question, the other concept we had was to call to form something called the university support pool, which would again the tuition pool. The notion on it is, it's a pool of money that's aggregated in the first instance and then distributed back out to the colleges. The provost wouldn't use it for anything else other than supporting undergraduate education. The difference between allowing the tuition to go directly to the college versus having it come first under a university pool is that we distribute it in a more thoughtful manner, and we think, create more space for the deans and faculty and the provost to have a conversation about academic priorities and the delivery of undergraduate education if we take away some of the immediate financial considerations around how tuition dollars flow. So that's kind of the reason for it. When I refer to this thing called the university support pool, the notion on that is that most revenue streams, and again, this would be the specifics of it would get worked out in an implementation phase, but that revenue streams that come into the university would be taxed and contribute to the greater good of the university. So when I said undergraduate tuition would come into this pool, the only piece that would not go back out to the colleges is some element that would be taxed and be put into this university support pool. We would tax undergraduate tuition, we would tax professional tuition, we would tax the net activity in campus life, for example, perhaps. I mean, there's elements here of different activities, executive education, the golf course. I mean, a variety of activities. It says, what are activities that bring money into the university and that should contribute to advancing the university as a whole? And when we define those revenue sources, we would tax them to a certain extent. The tax may vary based on activity, so it wouldn't be that tuition would get the same tax as some other revenue, but the framework would be that we would tax these revenues and would create a pool of resources for the provost to be able to make strategic investments for the institution. Recognizing that the way what we heard in the task force and what we heard internally and when we heard from other institutions that we talked to, it's really important as you think about these budget models that you don't starve the center. If the provost doesn't have monies to invest, the institution really doesn't move forward because the deans within their own financial realm can't take some of the gambles that you might take on as an institution. You can't make the big investment in a facility. You can't make the big investment in a program, a new program, a new initiative. The dean just doesn't have the flexibility to make those gambles. And so you need the provost with sufficient resources to really advance the institution long term.
And I think the other thing that it does is it allows the provost to invest in programs which cross colleges.
Absolutely.
So it allows him to invest in economics as a program or you name it, that goes across a whole bunch of different colleges, which is difficult for the colleges because they're each concerned with their own silo, as it were.
Right. And so in the budget model, we're largely putting the resources, if I could just really quick, we're largely putting the resources out in the units in which it's earned. So the provost doesn't have any resources or has minimal resources. There's some endowment that's held at the institutional level. But in general, doesn't have sufficient resources without somehow taking from the other resources that come in. So it's a somewhat decentralized budget model. We're calling it a hybrid model. There are some budget models that are very, very decentralized, little resources at the center. There's other models in which you just pool everything and everyone comes to the provost when he or she wants something. And we were trying to get what we're calling a hybrid model. And so to your question on the investments and initiatives, there would be this support pool that would be at the provost realm. Again, this exact sizing of it, we hadn't set as a task force. We were estimating it probably needs to be in the magnitude of 10 to 15% of the operating budget, which is in the magnitude of about $125 million now. Yes, here and then I'll come over here. Yes, sir.
Okay, so right now we essentially have, you know, seven main colleges. They, you know, and this university has kind of found each college has been very strong and self-run, and the university has been, for lack of a better term, kind of a weak overhead. You know, it seems like we're going from a college-centered model to a university-centered model, at least for some funding streams. But I know some colleges are more expensive to run, or some units are more expensive to run than others. And my concern is that if we don't address in a consistent manner all revenue streams, then the colleges will then be forced to, you know, this model, all these models are complex. You know that well better than anybody else here. But if you don't have a holistic model that covers all the revenue streams, then the colleges get into, okay, so this is how this one works. So they end up gaming the other models,
right,
to the detriment of how those funding streams work, because certain faculty are more expensive than other faculty depending on their disciplines and just all a number of buildings and age of buildings and hosts of other factors. So is your task force being integrated with others, I mean, for a kind of a holistic hybrid, so to speak?
Try to answer that. Yes, we believe so. It's actually been an interesting, 6 months as other task force work, and we were trailing behind some of the other task force work, the college planning and some of the cross college task forces the provost had set up. We were trailing behind those, and as those conversations, with people reporting out on it, people kept turning to, well, the budget model will solve this issue, because there were issues in there around decision making, programmatic investments, that you need a budget model underlying it. So yes, I think the response to your question, we believe we've got a single model which treats like revenues in a like manner for all colleges, all revenue streams, that you can see that.
People love or hate any model, but if it's consistent, they can learn to live within it.
We think it's consistent and people can live within it. There's pluses and minuses, but we do think it's common for all, and and it wouldn't depend on what unit you know you're sitting in at the backside.
And the flip side is checks and balances. Now we're going to very provost centered, so there's an individual there who may or may not have tremendous financial background and could be well advised, of course, but what are the checks and balances to make sure that
No, great question. We actually don't think this is a provost-centered model.
Oh, okay.
So the task force actually believes it's probably a bit more, if you were to put it on a spectrum, you know, more of a decentralized model because largely the resources are going to flow back out to units. We've pooled undergraduate tuition, but not given it to the provost to decide on any kind of activity. It's going back, other than this element that will get taxed, let's say it were 5% tax. Other than that 5%, the 95% goes back out to the undergraduate colleges. The provost, in a you know well-communicated distribution methodology, colleges will know what it is, would distribute the money back out. But it's still not, it's not money controlled by the provost. It's investing, it's putting resources out in the undergraduate colleges. If you look at how the undergraduate colleges get their money right now, arts, architecture, architecture, art and planning, engineering, there's no underlying basis. I'm in the budget office. I can't tell you what's the basis for their allocation. Is it based on students, based on this? I can't tell you that. There is no basis. Probably historical, and then it's been incremented or decremented over time, but there is no basis right now where you can say, I get it. If you look, go in the contract colleges, the distribution of state appropriation funding, which is a big part of their funding, there's no basis. It's historical, incremented or decremented over time. It's not based on faculty or students or research activity. I mean, so we're in a model right now in which there's elements that are largely centrally controlled and not well defined. We're actually advocating a model that we use the term data informed, not data driven. So there's room for judgment here, but it will largely be data informed about how the money's move out, and in that sense, it makes it, we think, a more distributed model. The only piece that the provost would really have the authority, full authority over, is this university support pool, and at the scale of what we're talking about, it's kind of the realm of which the provost makes decisions right now. In terms of checks and balances, if I just come back around to that question, the critical part of what we're talking about, because we're out of balance right now. We've got a huge budget problem. We've made investments that. Our budget models did not serve us well to see, did not serve us well to keep things in balance. And so what we think is this will actually be a much more transparent system. It will keep, it will put a constraint around and be very clear to folks how much resource is available for new activity. And and it will be a place where our CFO is really the checks and balance on it. From an internal control standpoint, our chief financial officer is that check and balance on the provost, and that was not well designed up until this past year. I mean, we put that control in place. I'm going to go here, and then I'll come back over here. Yes, sir.
Yeah, the state schools, of course, charge less tuition. The question would be, how do you handle, and there are two problems related to that. One would be, of course, that there are a lot of people from state schools taking courses in Dallas. And now there's problems with the state schools paying for courses for students taking them in Dallas. So is this a way of getting around that? Are you going to take from schools that charge less tuition to give it to schools that charge more tuition in order to make up for the courses? And the second question to that is, do you see academically any pressure, therefore, to have schools compete to raise attendance in courses so that undergraduate education will increase in their particular places so they get more money back from the model?
That's a great question. Let me try to address both of them separately. To your first question on the recognizing that for in-state students in the contract colleges, New York State resident students, they pay a lower tuition. Out-of-state students in the contract now pay the same. So that tuition gap is a roughly $16,000 gap. What our proposal was that we do receive state tax dollar support, and that state tax dollar support comes to us to help subsidize. It comes to us for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, but it's a small amount relative. At least what I've heard from people in the arts college, for example, is that there's a relatively small amount to compensate and it's been going down and it's harder.
So let me. That's your second question.
Yeah.
So
okay. Good.
Let me try to address that.
Right.
So to the first question of how are we valuing financial value we're putting on students, we want to have a common treatment for all students. We want to value them in the same manner. Our proposal was to take from the state appropriations, commit a piece of the state appropriations, the amount of money necessary to value the resident students as the same as all other students. So conceptually, and we were going to do that net of financial aid, on an average basis, that's about $9,000 difference per student when you consider financial aid. We would take, it's roughly $25 million of the state appropriation money and put it in the undergraduate tuition pool. So then when you distribute it out, all students are valued the same in the pool. So that's to your first question. To your second question, which is how do we compensate across colleges for teaching?
And related to that is, do you see a pressure on some colleges to increase and to curtail taking out of college courses?
So on the methodology first, and then the dynamic question, very important question. Second, the process issue is, as we distribute undergraduate tuition, we would consider where, one of the factors would be where courses are taught. We currently have something in the system we call accessory instruction, which actually we distribute the tuition and then on the backside we pass out a bill to say to all the colleges that say your students taught X amount of credit hours here, and we do this billing that kind of balances the trade, and it's not balanced right now. The endowed side subsidizes what's coming from the contract colleges. And so methodology, we would drop that billing. We would just, in the distribution of tuition, we would recognize where courses are being taught. To the second question about the incentives for folks and how do we make sure those incentives don't become perverse in people's behaviors, we actually think by pooling this and allowing the distribution methodology, that the methodology just won't weight. We have to be careful on how we weight things so that we don't weight the incentives such that it creates those incentives. You teach one more student, you get one more dollar. There's ways of developing the distribution methodology that doesn't make the incentive reward system so direct. It is very direct right now. And so in our current system, we do have places in which you can see over time that they've taught more undergraduates because it's, I don't know if it's because, they've taught more undergraduates and therefore have received more income. I don't know what the incentive was. I won't go there. But we have that in our system right now. Not picking on any unit, but Johnson School teaches more undergraduates than they used to. They get more tuition dollars. Hotel, years ago, the provost capped the amount of tuition that would flow to them because they have a very popular course there called the Wines course. and you could drive a lot of money and we don't do that. So the provost, years ago, put a constraint on that to counter the possible impacts of that. We viewed that, we talked a long time about that, and viewed that in many ways is a management issue. It's not so much the budget models can put a framework around it, but at some point the provost and deans have to manage it. And we really believe that by pooling undergraduate tuition, we provide, it's a better space to have the conversation about who's teaching what, why, and we just, in the distribution of the dollars, we make sure that it's not weighted in a manner that would reward, simply for teaching more students. There's got to be a reason for doing it.
This intersects with the question that's been aired around. It's not a rumor, it's beyond that, but, too many economics courses, too many areas. It intersects in the following way, that it seems to me like the provost's office and the dean of faculty's office, work together to think about a comprehensive view of how the university is working. We're a great university for offering diverse courses and by offering a range that's unrivaled in any Ivy League school, from my point of view, at least in terms of accessibility. And that should be kept so that a student taking music can take a farming course, and not feel like this is something that, is taxing the university. It's what the university is about. But it takes a kind of vision at the top to promote that as Cornell's real strength.
Right.
And to promote it in such a way that colleges don't compete that they actually see themselves as synergistic.
Right. And that's what, so I use the term management, but it's really what you were talking about, that it allows for, you know, academic program management, or management of the academic program without the financial differences in financial incentives driving, you know, people to have a different, you know, a framework as they come to the table on those discussions. So that's what we're hoping and why we think there's value in it.
Sure.
In it. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I don't know where to start. If the President of the United States had announced that since he was the only one who really had the interest of the whole country at heart, he would like a 10% tax on all incoming revenue to dispose of only if he saw fit, this would seem like a crazy idea. There would be a lot of opposition to it. And I feel the same way about the governments of universities. The idea of the provost taxing all incoming revenue streams and using them for purposes that the provost decides are important is just incredibly autocratic and centralized. I think our present provost is a wonderful person. We've had a strong provost in the past who contributed enormously to the current meltdown of this university. She had a lot of power. She decided, you know, she and President Rawlings decided how to spend money and how many commitments for debt financing of really expensive buildings and salaries and labs and whatever she spent it for. I mean, I hear a lot of figures, but the decline in the stock market is presumably responsible for only about 30% of our current difficulty, and the rest of it is due to bad decisions by provosts, I think, and presidents. I don't see how more concentration of power is going to keep us out of that kind of horrible situation. A provost comes from a particular discipline. Provosts have their own ideas. Biddy Martin thought we should have a great, expensive new AAP building, and she and the previous dean were the only people who made that decision, and from then on, it was golden. That kind of decision-making has really gotten us into this horrible mess where we're consuming ourselves and selling off and closing libraries and not hiring faculty and shrinking our graduate classes, and we're in a really terrible state because of that kind of autocratic decision-making using very bad judgment. Why would we want to create more power in the office of the provost? I think probably it's true that over time an irrational budgeting system has grown up and should be rationalized, and this should, you should have a wide viewpoint, a wide canvassing of viewpoints and arguments and real deliberation. Not just one person saying, I think I know where the university should invest its money, so give me 10% of all revenues and I'll put the money there.
Right.
That's a formula for disaster.
Right. So the other element of our recommendation is that it's not the provost doing it in a vacuum, that there's a budget advisory group, a wide representative budget advisory group.
Appointed by the provost, I bet.
I don't know the process on it, but it would be widely represented.
Why not let the Faculty Senate decide on the formula for distribution of revenue and the new areas of investment? And I think the Faculty Senate would do a better job of it, represents the whole university. I think it'd do a better job than a single provost, as witness our past experience. There we go.
So I'm not going to go down the path of whether it should be the Faculty Senate or the provost, because I mean, that's a different... That can be debated. So what we are talking about is recommending that there is an advisory group to the provost that is broadly represented.
By the provost, dependent on him.
That's how about elected.
So what's that?
Yeah, how about
an elected board?
How? No, I think it will be. So it could have elected representation on it. It might have, it probably will have Faculty Senate or Financial Policies Committee to Faculty Senate representation. I know they're advocating for
why
it.
Why not a broad smattering of the expertise at the university is chosen by all the different departments?
But I think, so this is, one, nothing's been decided, so if you really oppose it, give your feedback to the provost. The recommendation on it is, right now, let me frame it in where we're coming from. I don't think, and many believe, many advocated for the for us to create this pool. Some advocated for it to be larger because institutionally we don't move forward without the provost being able to make cross-college, cross-disciplinary investments. Now the scale of it is going to be controlled in a much better manner. It's going to be a defined amount. So that's part of what we were trying to get at. It is a defined amount. It's not a blank check. It is a defined amount. And it will be done in what we advocated for in the report was that it, one, would be reported out to the community how it's being spent. Two, it would have an advisory committee advising the provost on how it's being spent. So the framework from a task force standpoint was not trying to invest all the power in one individual without
exactly
advisory.
But that's exactly what it does. The decision that you described, the system you described, that's all power in one person in the provost.
But yeah. Elizabeth, currently, all the power is, in fact, invested in the president of the university, who can do roughly anything he wants.
Which is a bad situation.
Well,
but
that's the way the bylaws read.
Last year, that to try to avoid debt financing decisions made by very small numbers of people,
mm-hmm.
and to have some kind of broader participation and debate about huge expenditure commitments made by the university, because we don't want to go through mm-hmm. this again. We're in terrible shape. We're being perhaps permanently damaged as a university. Our place in the world is being damaged because of bad decisions made by very few people. With a lot of us complaining around it and never being heard.
Let's move on because we're running out of time.
So let me really quick move on from the budget model.
Add quickly that there is a mechanism for additional feedback on the reimagining study, which is a link right off of the homepage. And Paul's task here is really, you know, to help you understand and carry the feedback. But I think his point was well taken that if Elizabeth, is, you know, you feel strongly, the more times it's said, I think it's important to do that, and that would get to other folks too. And I think that's
or
important.
I can add one other thing: if the university assembly collectively feels that this aspect needs to be vetted more, addressed, feel free to write a resolution that we can all weigh in on.
That's a good point.
To allow the president to know that our concern, we trust Paul and company to come up with a wonderful model, but we want to make sure the oversight mechanisms don't lead to the problem.
Yeah, ours was a proposal is all it was. Yes, sir.
At what level do you see the assessor operating? At college level? So, for example, I have a clinic service. Right now, I pay 15% tax to the vet school for money that comes to my clinic. Am I now going to have the dean take his 15% and now you take another 10%?
Right. No, most likely not. So there's a cost.
Not.
Well, no, because I don't know the situation.
No,
I it would be foolish for me to.
Well, it's just a model of federal tax, state tax, local tax.
Our proposal is there's a reasonable level, and we've got to find that reasonable level in which, one, it makes sense to. Two, it would be commonly accepted. People would say, yeah, I get it. Whether you don't like the autocratic nature of it, that's one. But the notion, if we're going to do it, what kind of revenue would get taxed? That's a decision that we really deferred to the implementation.
But this would be separate from grants and contracts.
Yeah, and you shouldn't assume when I say 10 to 15% that that's the tax.
No,
that's the size of the pool. The provost is starting with probably endowment income that accrues to the provost of probably half that amount already between gifts that come in that are just come to the institutional level and endowments that are held centrally. So when I say 10 to 15%, that was sizing the pool, not sizing the tax. The tax likely would be no different, but I don't know. That is the methodology. So let me go on and just kind of really briefly talk about the financial situation of the university so you're aware of that. Our current situation, I'm going to speak to it from a budget standpoint. The approved budget of the university for this current year is a $68 million deficit. So that's current year. Had we not done anything, we did actually get a lot between fiscal 09, we're what we call fiscal 10 right now, and it ends June 30th, 2010. Between last year and this year, there was a lot of change budgetarily throughout campus, resource reductions. And had we not done anything, that $68 million deficit would have been pushing 120, probably a little bit over 120. We did do something at $68 million right now. If we do nothing going forward to next year, we let revenues hit the way they will with tuition increases as they are, endowment payout reduction, the trustees we need to reduce our payout from the endowment again, given the loss of value. When we implement all those actions, just you know, normal course of business, our deficit would actually grow from $68 million up to about $86 million is our projection right now. So hey, were we to do nothing going into next year, it would grow. We're obviously not going to do anything. I think that was bad English, but we are going to do something. We are going to do something here. It's not that we're going to let it ride. So, but I want you to understand, we're at $68 million. If we were to do nothing, it would grow to 86. We're going to take this down significantly this next year. The exact amount, we're going to be figuring it out over the next few months. But it's probably going to go down into the 30 million-ish range of the deficit. The trustees have allowed us the flexibility to resolve the budget issue over a number of years. The president and provost are very concerned that we do this right and not just kind of do it in a blunt manner, that we do it as informed as possible and as strategic as possible. Last year was a 5% reduction across the board. It was very blunt. But on the scale of what we were looking at, we knew it was a first step. This next year, we're hoping and working to do it much more strategically. So just give you the scale of the numbers, that's where we're at financially. Now to the kind of the strategic component of it, the last element I wanted to talk about, the administrative cost savings initiatives. We are working really, really hard and aggressively to understand where can we get some cost savings out of the university without touching academic programs. It will touch support for academic programs, but we're trying to not touch faculty positions, not touch, you know, activities that directly support students. And so where are we looking? We're looking in the procurement area, the purchasing area. We have a big opportunity. Our biggest single opportunity is in the purchasing area about how we buy goods and services. There's a large amount of our spending here that's not managed in any sort of controlled manner. So controlled manner means that we actually have a limited set of vendors. We negotiate aggressively the contracting and the pricing around those vendors, and we make sure we spend with those vendors so that we can deliver for the vendor what they're expecting out of it. We have something like 30,000 vendors in our system right now. When an institution, consultants would say that an institution our size should have more in the magnitude of, you know, 2,000 or less, and we've got over 30,000. We can't manage that way. We're wasting a lot of money. So we're going to see process changes. We're going to see changes, you know, you all, faculty and staff, I don't think the students will see it so much, but faculty and staff will see that we're going to change the purchasing arena. But we're doing it because it's a trade-off. We actually then can save money. We've got to resolve the budget somehow. If we can do it in this arena, it saves positions, both faculty and staff positions. So procurement, we're going at really aggressively. We're looking really aggressively at how we provide IT support on campus. So desktop services, how we manage development of new applications. So I expect some, you know, changes in that arena. We'll likely, this one crosses both, we'll likely, you know, look at how standard, and I don't know the answer to this, so take it as a really emphasis on the how, but how standard can we go around desktop, you know, computer purchases, and where can we afford standardization and where can we not? So that's why I would say the how. I don't want anyone to assume that every part of the university would be limited to one option, but if we could limit where it doesn't matter, in my office, it makes absolutely no difference. We could all use the same kind of desktop, and a lot of offices are like mine. If we could do that, we actually could save significant monies. So we're looking for opportunities along those lines. The IT arena, as I said, the facilities arena, how we deliver maintenance support, building care support, we're looking hard at that. And then around transactional activity in the finance arena, financial processing, how we pay bills, how we buy goods and services, payroll, human resource processing, how we appoint people, we're looking hard at all those activities. So I expect that, I don't want to minimize the impact of that. I think it will have a significant impact on campus. But if we succeed on it, it will have an impact in the non-academic arena, which is what our objective is. We can't make this change without some impact. So I don't want to minimize that, but put you with the emphasis. Yes, sir.
Well, you said support, not faculty, and support for faculty. I mean, I've seen in many departments and where you can't really separate the so-called support from the And now I don't mean necessarily administrators supporting faculty. I'm talking about lectures.
Right.
And I'm talking about, and when are we going to see the great savings in those very obvious areas like supply translated to be able to regain the academic side of,
yep.
of because it may be that we lose faculty positions. So, you know, I understand that they're not as significant as some other places, but we're losing lecture positions all over the place.
So my, when I use the term support, I was not putting lecturers in that category. I was putting them in the category of academic programs. So just to be whatever in my term, but I understand what had happened over the last year.
Yeah.
So the when on it, we that's what actually we will know in about 3-4 weeks. We're trying to assess how much out of the areas I've mentioned we think we can get in savings in fiscal 11, next fiscal year, and how much we think we can get over the next 5 years.
Can we rehire? No, I'm serious. I'm saying, you know, the program actually grew in a way that was, I mean, it may have been a striving in some departments, not mine. Anyway.
Right.
But the point is that academic programming grew significantly, and yet, you know, it's being undercut now significantly by the loss of lecturers.
So, yeah, I don't think we're going to be in a position to rehire. Right. What we're trying to stem is the decline. And then put us in the best position. So, I mean, things will turn.
Right.
And that when they turn, we are in that position quicker than we would otherwise. And we're trying to stem the decline. We're in a deficit situation, and we need to correct that deficit. And if we can do it out of the non-academic areas, or activities of the university, then we just kind of stem the decline and be in the best position possible. We actually are trying to do it in a manner that allows the provost and the deans to think about strategic hiring next year. That's part of what we're trying to do here,
right.
is to if we can determine the budget action and understand what it means administratively, if you will, and academically, how that split is. And our goal is obviously to maximize it in a non-academic arena. Then it actually allows the deans and the provost to have a conversation about, I want to move on faculty hiring now next year. And now I'm not saying that as a blank check, and it will be different between colleges, but our objective is to give the deans and the provost some space to have that conversation. I don't know what the outcome will be, but we're trying to create that space as quickly as possible.
Yes, two observations. One thing that people have pointed out for years is the waste of fossil fuel, the contribution of climate change and the sheer waste from having lights and heat on all night, all the time.
Yep.
And in my department, my chair and I go by, we try every night to go by and turn off all the classroom lights. But they're very complicated. There's 3 or 4 different switches in every room.
Yep.
Nobody really knows how to turn them off. Motion-sensitive lights would be a really good investment there. If you walk around the campus at night, the buildings are all blazing, creating light pollution, and I just haven't seen any improvement at all on that in the last 2 years. So that seems to be a place we could save money and be good to the environment.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I just forgot that in my comment. We believe that we're targeting probably about $10 to $12 million of recurring annual savings we think can be had through energy conservation. It will take the capital investment. But let me say differently. There are some activities that I'm hearing about. So we've got groups working on that right now. Our intent is to actually, our target is to achieve savings in what I'm saying.
It could work really fast if you just made an investment in motion-sensitive lights in classroom buildings.
So that's what's being evaluated right now. There's some activities that don't need any kind of investment. If we can just adjust the ventilation controls in labs. Which is the single largest energy use on campus.
Heating buildings all night long with nobody's in them.
So we're going. So there are folks looking real aggressively at that. We actually are trying to find the resources so that when we do have to make a capital investment, because we do believe we will on some issues, not on all, but on some issues, that we will. And our target around this. So when I go back and say what's our fiscal 11 savings versus 5 year savings. Again, our planning number right now is in the $10 to $12 million range around energy conservation.
Why don't you just in the short term, while you're waiting for all that to happen, get building managers to really look into it, mobilize faculty. I think people would really like to do this.
Elizabeth, these are good suggestions. And put them, send them to the provost.
Oh, I've done it for years.
Okay.
Nothing happened. I just want to make one other point. I think that the centralization of procurement, which we hear talked about all the time as if it's a great solution, And maybe it'll help, and I'm sure there's a lot of places the same. But one, it's going to have a huge impact on the community. It already is. And I know a business that just heard about last week that's going under because Cornell Dining is going to expand all the catering, not going to hire local caterers. Local businesses are going to be devastated by this. I mean, if you may find out that you can get white bread cheaper from Des Moines, Iowa, than you can, buy local whole wheat.
Yeah, it's like that. So they're actually our chief financial officer and procurement director of the purchasing services actually met with the Chamber of Commerce a week ago and had this kind of dialogue with them. And here's what the dialogue was. We can do it that way, or we can lay people off. And the impact on the community, I mean, we've got to balance the budget. And so the more we can do it out of non-personnel, we think has less economic impact on the community than laying people off. Because there's a ripple effect. If you
but
take
there are many
dollars,
times because of lower shipping costs and so on, that you can actually get local whole wheat hamburger buns.
Cheaper
than you can get them all.
Our purchasing folks are looking at that. So when we say preferred vendors or limited vendors, it shouldn't be assumed that that means it's always outside the community. They're looking at that.
We're talking about going from 30,000 vendors down to 2,000. That's just total devastation for small businesses in this community.
It depends on where that all falls out. I just don't know where that all falls out. There's not 30,000 vendors in our community, so the base is not just in our community right now. I mean, your point's well taken, but there's another dynamic here that we do have to make a reduction. And so we do believe that economic impact on the university
and all that, it makes sense to do it nationally or internationally. But a lot of the little stuff, especially food products and so on, I just hope they're going to be careful about that. Because I think we get better, healthier food and we save transportation costs if we purchase
them. I trust that they are, because it's a big issue of concern for them. I really do trust that they are.
Paul, I think we really ought to move on.
Okay.
But thank you so much for coming and for a frank and forthright exchange of views.
Whenever you want.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thanks a lot.
See you.
I wonder, Bill Fry is with us, Dean of the Faculty, and I wondered if it would be all right to move the resolution on Faculty Senate Child Care Services Committee up and postpone action on approval of the minutes and committee updates until we've dealt with that. Would that be all right with everybody? Who's going to present the resolution on the Faculty Senate Child Care Services Committee?
Who's the delegate? Who's the delegate to that committee?
I'll be me. I'm Preston Manchel. I suppose I can present it. So I'm one of the authors on it, and I'm a graduate student. I'm a graduate student who serves on the Child Care Subcommittee. It's a subcommittee of the Family Service Committee of the UA Assembly. And the resolution that's in front of you is just six, and it's essentially supporting the Faculty Senate resolution that will be presented at the next meeting, the March 10th meeting. And so the Faculty Senate resolution is born out of a significant dissatisfaction of how the current Cornell Child Care Center is being operated. And there is a significant dissatisfaction amongst the faculty members themselves with children in the program due to high turnover rates within the program of the administrators and the teachers within the center. And then also, because it's a very competitive process to get in, not a lot of the faculty members aren't able to get their children within the center itself. I believe that's an overall gist. I'd be happy to take any questions or comments.
Yeah, we are supposed to, this is supposed to be our committee. I'm not saying that in a possessive way, I'm saying that in a discouraged way, because I would have expected that we would have heard more about this earlier. And I'm not faulting you for that at all. I'm saying that I'm faulting us. And we really have to have a lot more vigorous participation, because these are issues that were brought up at the outset when this committee was formed, when the center was proposed, when there were construction documents about it, and when we contracted with, or we're still with, the place Bright Horizons, I guess. And I'm just really concerned that we're not doing a good job, and would like to know if the committee, which I guess you're on and at the meetings, has any suggestions to us to make us more responsible. Can you send a representative to be on the UA so that that person would then, whether it be a staff person, graduate student, or whatever, can you find a way of getting somebody on our committee, on our UA, that who can, you know, keep representing the problems and questions that are raised? That would be the first step.
I'll bring that to the committee. And I think one of the issues is that there was a drafted set of guidelines that was presented to Bright Horizons on the onset of the formation of the organization itself. And they haven't satisfied a lot of the points that were actually made. And so there's been this contentious kind of battle back and forth between how does the Cornell respond to it. And so I believe that their contract is up in 2014. Is that correct?
It was 5-year
contract. It's only been a year. Yeah, so 2014. About 5 years from now. And so then there's a significant penalty for Cornell if we actually pull out of the contract with the organization. But there is now, how do we actually put pressure on them to conform to the actual procedures that they need to perform?
Well, the Family Services Committee came out of the Human Resources Department, and we took it over because at the request of Mary Opperman and others, so that it would be more responsive to the university-wide, and it would be a more democratic, I guess you could say, circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
But the contract was negotiated not by the committee, but by the Human Resources and by people on that committee prior to the time. What I guess I'm saying in all this is that it would seem to me if there was going to be some jawboning or whatever it is that's done nowadays, it would be directly through the people that were responsible for putting in place.
Well, certainly, when I read something, I don't even know what these are. Unacceptable rates of incident reports, Child Protective Services. There's got to be a clause in any contract that I don't know what that entails, you know, but you could certainly get out of it if Bright Horizons, you know, is, I don't know what you report. You know, what, are you left to get alone in a corner? I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't like that either.
Some of those are things like they left a stapler in the changing room. And so Bright Horizons was saying that they actually pride themselves in over-reporting these issues, where they report back to their supervisors or anything that could actually go back. But there's also significant, like, serious hazardous risks that have been reported, and these are incidents where there hasn't been a staff person in the room with the children for a certain amount of time as well. And so I don't know if within the contract itself there is a clause such as that to exist, where if you have a certain amount of these unacceptable risks or errors that go on within the organization that you actually pull out of the contract. But if there is, I imagine Cornell would exercise that clause.
Can you give me the number?
A fundamental question. Why is having a faculty committee to be involved in this going to help the situation? It seems to me we already have a committee which is representative of the people that are benefiting from this child care. Why is an additional committee going to help, and what's it going to do?
So for the additional committee, the initial thrust of the idea is the fact that a lot of the members who initially tried to get their children in the Cornell Child Care Center and was trying to utilize the services of child care from Cornell were faculty members and younger faculty members. And they weren't able to get to those services. A lot of them pulled out of actually trying to advocate for it because they found other child care services around campus. And then from the faculty standpoint itself, on the back of it is all the faculty members who actually are advocating for the committee to be formed. There was a kind of a grassroots effort in order to try to get their voice to be heard that there needs to be the services on campus. And the redundancy of the committees, both from the University Assembly and Faculty Senate, would increase the amount of stakeholders in the aspect, and it would provide another layer of people actually overseeing the operation. Does that address your question?
Yes, it does. It just seems to me it would be an unfortunate way to proceed, because I think by the time you have two committees that are trying to supervise an entity or try to help organize it, They're going to get in one another's way, and so I guess I'm not enthusiastic. I'd like to fix the present committee, and as Marty said, if it's not working, let's try and find ways to see if we can help.
And I wanted to put two words in. One is there's an ex officio non-voting UA representative position open on the committee that ideally a member of the UA would be able to fill to serve as that connection with the child care committee. And I think there is, when Mary Opperman proposed moving this committee over, this committee had been intended to serve as sort of a general child care issue committee.
Services.
And there is actually another committee just for the parents of associated with that center that, as I understood, it's supposed to serve more in that oversight role of that specific horizons issues.
Right. There's a subcommittee of the Family Services Committee, I think it's is that what our
that's the child care services.
That's the child, yeah.
Subcommittee that we're
okay, on. Well then the bigger one is the bigger one is the one that we are, which is I kind of agree. I agree with Charlie on that. We ought to find a way of getting our committee much more vigorous, and if it means adding people to it from this list of folks, I mean, you know, maybe you want 10 more, I don't care, but the point is, we may not care, but the point is get it more vigorous and doing the job it was set out to do. We just don't, I guess, have the people do it. When we started the committee, somebody on UA was eager to be that member, but now it's not. So,
Bill, do you have any opinion as dean?
Most of you know have been involved with this much longer than I have, but my impression is that there has been deep satisfaction, particularly but not exclusively, within the faculty as to how things are operating. And I think there's also been, I believe, some tension between this UA committee and the faculty members who are listed on that resolution. I think the fact that this resolution has surfaced may have already brought sufficient attention that people are really tuned in. I've talked with both with Mary Opperman and with Lynette Chappell-Williams about this. They both say they support the resolution that is signed by those 25 faculty members. And everyone also agrees, including Bright Horizons, that they're doing a bad job. It's been a very difficult time that they're in a different environment than they are accustomed to working in. You know, this is a sort of a rural, small community, and I think they're unaccustomed to working in that kind of environment. They're sort of a big city organization. And so they've struggled. They agree that everybody else agrees that they've struggled. But I think the issues have not resolved as fast as everyone would like. That would be Mary Opperman and Lynette. It would be them as well as the members of the people whose kids are there. I think it's not a good situation. Everybody agrees with it, and something needs to be done. Is what I sort of.
Thank you, Bill. Alice,
I agree with Marty and with you, and would point out that there are constituencies besides faculty that utilize that center, and I think if it's an ad hoc situation, we have faced these kinds of ad hoc charges before. The university assembly has, and I think the university assembly would be the best in the best position to address these kinds of issues, since it represents all of the constituencies. And regardless of the committee we already have, if there was going to be an ad hoc committee formed, we have had charges from the past presidents. You know, a past president. You know, look at these particular issues, and. You know, I would be more in favor of that, particularly because it's much more inclusive than just faculty.
Yes.
And if we were charged by the president, for example, to do something,
and basically just take all these whereases and substitute a university assembly committee, I think we could probably do, I won't say necessarily a better job, but maybe a better job than just a faculty committee.
Well, but it's it's representative of the group that is being served by this gym.
Well, and I recall last year we had great discussions about the cost and stuff, and, right. And I think some of the biggest dissatisfaction with the access and cost that graduate students would give,
right.
As well as young faculty, they were the two biggest stakeholder groups that had concerns, not with how low Bright Horizons is done, because that was an unknown quantity, but as far as how it was structured, its cost was higher than anything else in town, and its access was smaller, as an arrangement. So I guess the question really is, following on Ellis here, is what constructively can we do quickly? Do we need to as a university assembly, you know, what we're going to send forward to the president or not, and constructively move forward on the resolution at hand and take charge, or we're going to punt?
May I suggest that we consider appointing a large number of people who are on the list and concerned to be on the child care. It's actually the family services is the larger committee.
It is the child care is the subcommittee.
And child care is the subcommittee. To be on the child care subcommittee, it doesn't even have to be ad hoc. And the point is that committee then can do all the jawboning that it needs to and put together recommendations that we can act on. I agree with Ellis that one of the things that happened at the outset was of this was the question of how we're going to set fees low enough and scholarships and all this other stuff. I don't see that anywhere in this document, those issues, and how we're going to make it available to staff, for example, who have sometimes less money and greater need for care that's right where they're working than faculty who can afford a farther away place and more expensive places. And believe me, Bright Horizons was talking about that at the outset. And we actually put some provisions in. There were supposedly scholarship places. There were places being saved for a certain number for people who are trying to get lured to be in the faculty, those kinds of things. All those were being discussed. So it seems to me like this resolution, it looks a little bit too, special interest. And we ought to table it, I would say, and recommend, or even, the problem is we don't have our representative here, and we don't have somebody on the unless somebody wants to take it over for a short-term assignment to be the representative to try and negotiate this kind of thing. We need to, under the child, or not the child care subcommittee, although it would be a 1-2 kind of thing, the family services committee.
Marty, do I understand that you made a motion to table?
I made a motion to table. I made a move to table.
I don't know.
Sure. Now you have to discuss whether you want to table.
I think table is a good idea, but I would like to put something on the table.
Can we finish with the table before you put something else on?
I'm not sure if this is part.
All right, go ahead.
Well, you can make the table.
To say that in 1 month we put on the agenda for all these people that are really interested, that we will have that we'll put this on the agenda, so we're not blowing anybody off, but we put it on our work schedule.
I just want to put in, a clarification of what I said earlier about the original idea behind the child care committee. And my understanding that there's administrative support for forming this additional committee?
From the administrative side?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I think part of the idea behind that is that the child care committee was intended to focus on broader issues as opposed to oversight of Bright Horizons, and I imagine part of the reason they're supporting forming this new group is basically allowing that committee to focus on something other than grievances with Bright Horizons, because there are a lot of other issues on their plate. But
regardless of what the issues are, we're the forum to do it, not a faculty committee. And my fear is that if we meet in a month, this resolution, whatever we do, will already go to the faculty. Okay? And if the faculty supports it, then it will move on to Bill and the president, and we could conceivably be left out in the cold. This is our job. This is what we're supposed to be doing. This. If this is a specific issue that crosses boundaries between constituencies, and we're the body that's supposed to do it. I don't care what the name of the committee is. I don't care whether it's ad hoc or permanent. That's what we're supposed to do. That's why we're here, to address these exact kind of issues.
Would it be helpful maybe to have the chair, though, of the child committee?
Fine. You know, but my fear is that whatever's going to happen if, well, could we have something on the table, but my fear is that it's going to go before the faculty. The faculty, for whatever reason, is going to say, sure, go ahead and do it, and fait accompli, fine, we'll have someone on the larger committee. But this specific committee will already be formed, and in fact, something that is our province will have been taken away from us yet again.
Well, I am happy to attend the faculty senate meeting as a faculty member and
as well.
A representative of this body and communicate our views, whether anybody pays any attention, I don't know. I think for the moment, let's vote on whether we want to table this, which simply means we're not killing it, we're not voting against it, we're simply going to put it on the table, because I agree completely with Ellis. I think that this is something that we should be very much concerned about and try and fix, because it impacts all of us. And you're a graduate student, and then so, you know, in a way, this will give you more leverage than having a faculty committee involved.
I think that was one of the intents of the document, is to raise the attention to the wider university assembly body itself, of the discontent that's within the community itself, and not necessarily to have support for this resolution. It was just that we found out about this resolution that the faculty set up was at a pre-event about 2 weeks ago, and so we wanted to raise the concern of a wider body.
Yeah, no, I think that's fine. Can I call the question on tabling? Okay, all in favor of tabling? Ten in favor, all opposed? Abstentions? I'm afraid it looks to be unanimous to table it. But that does not mean that we don't care and won't do something about it. So we will proceed.
Well, one of the first things we can do is find somebody to be on the committee from our body. I mean, some of us are serving on other committees, so we can't do it. But I think, you know, I think it's important for one of us to step to the plate, at least at this point. I think forever, because the point is that, for as long as you're on the Senate, the point is everybody has to pull a little bit away beyond just the UA meetings.
Okay.
Great.
So I
make a motion that Ellis be our representative to the Family Services Committee, and then from that point you can be on the Child Care Subcommittee.
I second the motion.
Okay, we have a motion made and seconded. Any discussion of the motion?
Is
there
something out of it?
What a great guy.
Okay.
And I'll know if you when you can't make a meeting.
Okay.
All in favor? Again, unanimous. Thank you.
When is the next meeting? We need to get on the agenda.
You have my email address.
I bet Ari can find when the next meeting is.
March 31st.
March 31st?
Okay. The Senate is going to meet before that. So we ought to have somebody there, and we ought to have some research done about it before, so that somebody can talk about what our responsibilities are.
Yeah, if you can send me the...
Actually, Ari has such information about the Family Services Committee, right?
It's also on the website.
It's not going to be on the website.
Well, okay, we're talking about the Child Care Subcommittee of the Family Services.
Well, yeah. But no, I think I'm representative on the...
Family services,
and services,
but then you're going on child care as well, right. Unfortunately. That's okay.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm sorry, Elizabeth.
Just a quick question, just to throw out. There's something maybe Ellis can look at. If the core of the problem is located here in a sentence that says, a competing management proposal by the Ithaca Community Child Care Center was rejected, even though that center had an established record of providing care for many of the children of current past criminal faculty. They decided instead to go with a for-profit company, Bright Horizons, which is owned in whole now by Bain Capital, the bane of our current system. that seems like it might have been a really bad decision, and I just wonder who made that decision and why. To go with a Bain Capital for-profit, huge company, not, as we say, not a big city company, instead of a local one. This sounds like a decision to sort of knock down a local proven enterprise in favor of a very big company, and one would like to know why a decision like that was made.
I don't have the history behind me to make a full recommendation as to why Cornell went with the Bright Horizons, but I do know that there was a significant amount of staff members within Bright Horizons who came from Cornell, and so there was may have been a selection bias because of might have been an assumption that we have been getting better treatment by going with Cornell affiliation.
In any event, that is something we can investigate. I want to thank you for allowing me to rearrange the schedule. Can we move briskly along to approval of the minutes? Everybody, I assume, has read the minutes. Yes, of course. Any objections, corrections, deletions, additions, multiplications? Good. They're approved. Committee updates. Now, there were some committee updates that people wanted to talk about. Yeah.
The CJC just recently voted on two changes to the code of conduct. I'll send them to you for the next meeting for everyone to vote on. Just to kind of give you all a heads up on them, I guess. Change to the language in the prohibition on hazing in the code of conduct. Just the slight language to change, making it conform more with accepted practices at other universities and how they usually handle it. And also a change in the statute of limitations in the code of conduct. So I'll have those resolutions at the next UA meeting.
Excellent. Any other updates from any other committees? Hearing none. Marty, you wanted to have an opportunity?
I think we need a little clarification just to mention some correspondence. I just wanted you to tell us what you think what the background is for, recapitulate for us the background, because it went by very quickly, for the increase of latitude for suspensions from 1 to 5 years. As much as you can remember.
Is why that was the fourth?
Yeah, what was the rationale for it, and who does it affect most? That is, does it affect victims, perpetrators, prosecutors, adjudicators?
It affects multiple parties. From what I remember, the main justification was that before we made that change, what would happen would be that you could suspensions up to 1 year were okay, so for either 6 months or one semester or the year, or an indefinite suspension. And what would happen was cases would arise where an indefinite suspension seemed unwarranted and too much, but a year was too little. And so, for example, the main problem that was talked about in the CJC was a case where someone wanted to, a suspension for, say, 4 years, or if there was some sort of specific problem between an individual and another individual on campus, and that the consensus of the JA, the hearing board, and all the parties involved was that the accused should not be getting an indefinite suspension because they posed no risk to the community. And that what was involved was too harsh for an indefinite suspension or an expulsion, but that it would be best for all parties involved if the suspension would go until the other person graduated. So a 4-year suspension or however long it would be till that person graduated would be an example of a time when that would be, when the JA could say a 3-year or a 5-year, depending upon the program.
So the CJC actually understood this would be, and thought through and understood it to be, a case where actually it's to the defendant's advantage rather than to the prosecutor's advantage. to have the 5 year have a possibility of suspending 1, 2, or 3 years as opposed to either 1 year or indefinitely.
I was I'm hesitant to say only the defendants benefit because it does benefit the defendant in the sense that now they have that suspension instead of an indefinite one, but at the same time this arose because the hearing boards, which would have to approve any arrangements, were also very hesitant to give that indefinite suspension, and so you avoid the problem of potentially having only a 1 year suspension when something more would be warranted too. So it addresses
both
sides.
So that's the victim's advantage in the sense that the victim then doesn't have to deal with a person around just because the hearing board didn't want to offer an indefinite suspension.
Right. So I think my feeling is that the discretion benefits all parties involved because it addresses both sides of the issue.
Okay. And I have one other question of clarification. It had to do with the resolution that we passed. Is it your understanding that the resolution we passed, and I know Andrew's not here, but you can give your sense of it, was not a resolution having to do with discrimination, but was having to do with harassment, and specifically harassment of an individual, long-term or intense?
Yes, that was...
Not discrimination.
That was my understanding. Discrimination in the sense of just... To get out of the Kai Alpha incident. So this is an example.
No, I'm speaking of that. Our resolution had not
our resolution had nothing to do with that. That was my understanding, yeah.
Right. I would have said to change the title of the resolution had I noticed that there was a title. When we talked about changing discrimination to harassment.
I thought we did change the title.
Yeah.
I thought we changed the title. It's not a resolution against discrimination. It's against harassment.
Yeah. I got an email back from Andrew after I sent something to everybody, to the Sun, that we had changed the words discrimination to harassment. And Andrew said we didn't change the title.
Intended should be amended because I thought that I had said that discrimination would be eliminated from the title and that it would be eliminated from the body of the resolution.
I actually remember saying the whereas is, but
okay, I remember that, and there was also the word discrimination and harassment in the resolution, and we eliminated the word discrimination and reinstated harassment.
I think that the consensus coming out of opposing judicial committee, and I got the impression that there was the same feeling here, was that it didn't actually change the policy at all. It just made it clearer by including the specific classes in that paragraph.
Right. We're talking about whether it's a discrimination resolution or harassment.
Yeah, the title.
I don't think that the title was changed, but that doesn't change the effect of the resolution.
I thought the title did get changed.
I did too.
And
I'd amend the minutes if they don't say that it wasn't changed to say that it was changed.
I will look at the minutes and see what they say.
Right now. He also suggested other word changes. Andrew Brokman found these friendly. I think he suggested discrimination in the first whereas clause be replaced with harassment, and also suggested other word changes. So maybe that was where it got lost, but that should be there. It was removed from the title. That's my take on it. But.
Okay. I will look at that. Are there any other matters to come before the body?
Do we have any news on the resolutions? The outstanding resolutions?
Not any news at all. And I sent something up the flagpole after the last meeting, and I will follow up with a personal email to the president to see what I can do. I thought I would try to go through channels and be nice, but now I will be a little pushier.
Great.
You know, my feeling is you try the right, you know, the polite way, and then
you can always use the 30-day clock.
Well, yeah. In fact, that's what he had said when he came to our meeting, that he wants us. He wants to realize he takes all of our resolutions seriously and will respond to them in the proper amount of time. He said that.
I remember that. Yes. And I will remind him of that in a gentle way.
He's doing more discrimination than harassment.
I don't know. Okay, well, if there's no more, then I declare the meeting adjourned.
I just wanted to reintroduce myself to the committee. I'm Jim Blair. I was on the committee last year, and I changed jobs, and so I had to give up my faculty position on the committee, and I'm now back as an employee assembly member. I know we have two vacancies, and Leon has been in and out because of other commitments. If you have issues that you would like the employee assembly's help with, or to address, or to facilitate, I am one of the people that I look forward to working with you in that capacity. And I'm very pleased to be back, and thank you for having me.
Jim, we are delighted to have you.
And we'll volunteer for it for our people.
Yes, I'm going to come to Puerto Rico now and tour the observatory.
This is Emily Cusick. She's a former member of the SA. She's also on the Panhellenic Executive Board. She will be fulfilling Andrew Brockman's spot, who, even though he's still a member of UA, he switched over to SA and now serves as a liaison to the UA. So she will be our new official voting undergraduate member.
Yeah, welcome. I'm excited. This is a body I've never served on before. I used to be the liaison to the employee assembly, so I had a good time with that. And student assembly, so I'm looking to get new perspective.
Good. Well, welcome. Anything else for the good of the order?
Didn't we say something about new members having to provide all the food for the next meeting?
Ah, yeah. You didn't enjoy it?
Doesn't it?
No. I know Amy did this. I came early.
Very good. Well, thank you all.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been on it since forever.
Good to have
you back. This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.